endeavored today to keep the size of the group to something like seminar size, and as a consequence, it has not been widely publicized. It is larger than ordinary seminar size, but I think it perhaps still will have that degree of intimacy that will make for good communication. Many of you attended Dr. Myrdal's lecture last night, and in any event, you know him through his works and through his reputation. Accordingly, I'll keep my own remarks very brief. Dr. Myrdal is going to talk to us today on the topic, the Negro problem, or rather the race problem in America, in historical and international perspective. The perspective that he brings us is that of an eminent social scientist who has ranged broadly over the disciplines. It is the perspective of a practitioner who in many ways has been involved in public affairs and in the process of public policy making. Not least, it is a perspective of the author of The American Dilemma, a full quarter century after that work was first published. It's a pleasure to present Dr. Gunnar Myrdal.
Let me start by saying that I do not pretend to speak to you as an authority. 25 years ago, I probably knew more about the race problem in America than anybody else when I worked on an American dilemma, which to me was a very pathetic thing. It was my war work when people of my age were out as soldiers in the Second World War. Since then, I have not professionally devoted my scholarly exertions to that problem, but you will understand that I've tried to follow what was happening. As a matter of fact, I belong to this queer social scientist who devote regularly a couple of hours of secondary time to read periodicals and newspapers from all over the world, and quite particularly trying to follow what's happening in America. I will sooner or later have to fix my opinions about what is happening now, what's the future. I've evaded it, and in a shameful way, I promised my friends in the New York Times Magazine long ago that I should write an article, and I've not done it because I feel uncertain about so many things. 25 years ago, I could study the social forces and make a forecast what would happen in the next couple of decades, which turned out not to be too bad. And now you have a feeling that something might happen next week or next month, which is changing the prospect. Nevertheless, I'm not talking as authority. Let us talk afterwards and discuss it. You don't need to share my opinions, but you might be interested how I look upon it. Let me first take the international aspect of this problem and tell you something of which you might not be aware, because there is no literature on that particular aspect of the American race problem. I follow that naturally over the years, how the world is reacting to what happens in the race field in America. And very definitely, I can say that until quite recently, until a few years back, America had the sympathy of the world in its race problem. The intellectuals everywhere, both in the whole world, never equated America with South Africa. I mean, this is quite clear. The intellectuals of our type, you know, good liberal people, we made there a distinction. I've followed it carefully. America was looked upon as a country devoted to certain principles, ideals, which I call the American creed of equality and liberty and all of that. They had institutions like the Constitution, the Supreme Court, and many others who are trying to follow out that line. America was a country with great difficulties. You have inherited, I mean, all the legacy of slavery and all of that. And here you were in difficulties, were struggling on. This was, on the whole, a sympathetic attitude. As a matter of fact, of course, you cried out your sins over the housetops. I mean, all the information about what was happening in America then as now came from America. And I do believe that many people were in America were afraid that this publicity about the race problem was bad for the American image. It was not, because at that time, quite generally, it was looked upon as here you have a poor country who has inherited tremendously difficult problems and is trying to solve them. When the Little Rock events happened, I was in Australia, and I traveled back during the next weeks over all South, what I call South Asia. And almost nowhere was there any other idea than here they have had something now, this horrible, terrible. But the government is doing its best. They're even using their police force in order to desegregate, according to the Supreme Court. Begin that. It's a long story, but they will do it. This was the worldview of America up till a few years ago. That has changed, my friends. And now you have a very hostile attitude to America, which is partly based on the race issue. The background of that is less, in my opinion, although you might question it, the riots you had and the violence and so on, although they are now, of course, as always, publicized widely. The basis of it is, I'm firmly convinced, is this horrible Vietnam War. That is what has changed the world's attitude to America in many fields, and particularly on the race issue. How can we explain that? Well, the Vietnam War has turned practically the whole world against American foreign policy. There's no question. Governments, particularly dependent governments, are, of course, careful. Some business interests are careful to explain, but the peoples everywhere are against it. No, I've said that, and I say it now too, there is no European government who would dare for their people to send a squadron to help America in Vietnam. This is the real simple truth, which is, you see it from an American point of view, that these allies of ours, which we helped out in the First and the Second World War, and now they are leaving us absolutely alone in Vietnam. The basis is that you have this hostile reaction to the Vietnam War. I think, incidentally, that the Vietnam War, in historical perspective, will look as a tremendously dangerous and tragic happening in the world, because I think it has had a lot to do also with what has happened here in America. You see, psychologically, people's reactions are not always logical, but there are psychological things here, and that is that what is Vietnam as people see it. As a matter of fact, of course, here, as in the Negro issue, they are getting most of the horrible television pictures and most of the horror stories from American sources, although, of course, we get a good lot and more from friends. And even we Swedes have our correspondents and our television people in North Vietnam and South Vietnam, so we are trying to be able to feed ourselves. But a very substantial part of the horror comes from American sources, which is natural with your type of publicity, and good, I think. And there is a psychological association there, and that is that here, this huge, predominantly white country is cruelly killing off people, a little colored nations, you know. I think there's a psychological association there. This does not mean, for Lord's sake, that the race problem is an international one. I'm not going to come into that. We might discuss it afterwards. But this is a psychological association, which makes people less, tolerant, making them, in fact, intolerant towards American policies. This is a thing which has changed and which is very important. Let me, in bypassing, say another thing in another connection. We talked about this morning, a few students and I, that when this Negro rebellion began, I was in New York, and they organized a sort of meeting of high foundation officials and professors of psychology, psychosociology, economics, you know, which bordering to the Negro problem. And there was an absolutely unanimous opinion, which needed not to be argued, that there had been a vacuum of scientific interest since I wrote my book, not because I wrote the book, but in this period. Foundations and put a low priority on studies in this field, and professors didn't find it very appropriate to advise their brightest students to go into the race field. This had partly to do with what's happening in the race field at that period, to which I will come. Now, of course, we are going to have studies, and this confirms, of course, my general attitude that scholarship in science follows politics. Now it's on people's mind because it's important, and now you will have studied. But there was a long period of about 20 years at least when very little was done in at the universities and with the foundation aid and so on this issue. So that was the historical perspective, and then my little footnote on what's happening in the scientific field. And let me now go back to my old study, because that is, at least from my point of view, gives me a sort of entrance to discuss this problem as in historical perspective. When I worked here on that study, the consensus of the scholarly world, of my colleagues who were working on the race problem, was very much under the Sumner influence. Stateways cannot chain folkways. They looked upon me, some of them, at least, perhaps the majority, as a queer Swede who comes from a country where they can, by legislation, change mores, you know, and he didn't understand that it was quite a different thing here in America. They assumed that the Negro status would be about what it was. Nothing very, very much would happen. At that time, you can also say that the situation had been stagnant in two generations since the big compromise in the 70s. Some indices has been going upward a little, some others downward. You know, the whole Jim Crow legislation is mainly from the 80s, 90s, and even up in this century, which of course was working against the Negro status in American society. As I was working observing the forces which were operating in American society, I came to the conclusion that we were at the breaking point, and that from then on the Negro position in America would improve. This was one of the main conclusions I reached. And there I was correct. Incidentally, whenever you read, if you look in that old book, remember, not a comma has ever been changed in all the various printings. You know, I mean, it's been kept absolutely as it was written, ending 42 and printed in 44. Well, there I was correct, in other words, and very few of you who have not devoted particular study to this problem really are aware of how much was improved during these two decades, about the end of the war. You see, if you go back to the time when I was working on this problem, the situation was rather horrible, particularly in the South. The NAACP, which is now, after all, working rather hard, could not operate in most southern states. If they tried, they were driven out as interferers and communists. A planter in Mississippi, he needed labor. He could telephone the sheriff and say, round up 50 niggers for disorderly conduct and send them to me, they shall work for me. And this happened. The Negro workers in the turpentine industry were actually slaves. I mean, I could give many other examples. What happened during these 20 years, which I think we should keep in mind, was that is until the recent upheavals, was that whatever index you take, you see an upward movement. There were little more of Negro kids who got education. schools were becoming a little better. Courts were not so scandalously misbehaving as in my time. In my time already, the lynching had been stopped, you know, which played a lot of role earlier, but there was a lot of hidden lynchings, killings by the police and so on, which has had that in this period gone down. A few more Negroes were voting, and you can go through it. There are more Negroes getting into protected trades and having a promotion. It was going in that direction, and when my assistant at that time, whom I had taken when he was just a new graduate and very bright, and who is dead now, Arnold Rose, he died by cancer a year ago. He was professor at Minnesota University, which many of you know. He wrote an introduction, an introductory memorandum on what had happened when they produced the 20th anniversary edition, 44. We wrote that in 42, and there he enumerated what actually had happened. It had been going forward, and he looked forward, which few would have done at that time, to a time when formal discrimination would disappear and so on. This was what happened. So I was writing it for a social scientist who often have been incorrect in his predictions. This is, of course, always pleasant to remind at least oneself that I made the right study. I saw what the social forces, how they were operating, and I was correct. Meanwhile, however, a lot of other things happened, or rather at the end of the period. The migration from the rural areas to the cities and from the south to the north, which had begun, you know, already in the First World War and continued during the Depression, was carrying on. And as years passed by, this meant an increasing crowding in the Negro ghettos. You know, this became a pressing burden, so as towards the end of that period, which I oversaw, these 2 decades. There were other things which were happening at the same time, and that was, remember that the whole Eisenhower era, which I call, as an economist, I call that the period of relative stagnation. Of course, the American economic stagnation. As you know very well, Americans can always be pleased by being told that you have the highest national income you ever had, and why shouldn't you, for Lord's sake? The American population was in this period increasing by 1.7% every year. And if you do with America, as we do always with underdeveloped countries, reckon national income per head, then you had just an Indian creeping up. You had a little more than 1% advance during this period. And that reflected itself in a tendency to a very severe unemployment, as you will remember. And that employment, as always, following a mechanism which I had studied, inflicted quite particularly on the Negro population. This is one thing which happened. Then I do believe that we had, working particularly towards the end of Reagan, really an American thing corresponding to what they talk about as the revolution of rising expectations. As a matter of fact, I'm very critical against that concept when used on the underdeveloped world. And I think it's mainly a thing which happened to the educated crowd, which is an upper class crowd. I don't think it happens very much among the poor. But there is a difference. There are many elements of similarity between the situation in the ghettos and the situation in underdeveloped countries, but there are differences, most of them related to the fact that while the poverty-stricken people in America are only a small minority, while the rest of the people are well off, of course, in the underdeveloped countries, just the opposite, most of them are poor, and as a matter of fact, the poor are the majority even in the world. So this is a big difference. And that difference reflects itself here in this particular thing, that you have plenty of communication to get to, more than from it. You know, you have the newspapers, which are being spread even there, and spread increasing. It would be interesting to study what has actually happened to the spread of newspapers in the Negro communities in the North, I think you have had a rather rapid development, both of the Negro press and of other press. And then you had the radio, which during this period, these youngsters here don't remember how it was before we had television. You know, I mean, they remember this has not always been so. You see, here the radio were coming, and television is a new thing. And all that operated on the mind. And that in a period when gradually, but very slowly, actually the situation was improving for the Negro. And because of that, I do believe that there was, as Martin Luther King, I think, expressed it once, that there was a potential explosive dissatisfaction spreading in the Negro population. This is something which happened, and which I think has very much to do with a great increase in communication from the wider American scene to the people in the more and more crowded ghettos. The ghettos become more and more crowded, there's been more and more unemployment, on the whole there's been a rising tide, and here I think you have a place for a changed psychology, I mean more bitterness, more dissatisfaction in the Negro field. If I might go back to my old study again, I stressed, and I think this is right, and still would stand for it, that the main problem, main Negro problem, is a problem of the white people. The Negroes are not particularly, they are just ordinary Americans, ordinary human beings. It's nothing particular about them. The only particular thing is that they've been dealt with in a very specific way for a long, long period here in America. And this treatment of the Negro is, of course, in clear contrast to everything which the American majority, and particularly the educated part of it, describe as their ideals, and which is in the Constitution, the Supreme Court, etc., you have all of that. Because of that, it was a problem in the white mind. And I stressed one thing, which I think you still will have to believe, and that is that it was a moral issue. It was an issue in the heart of the Americans. They were split moral allegiance to their ideals and to the way in which they treated the Negro. Now, well, there were people at that time, incidentally, who thought this was a very idealistic approach. I don't think it's idealistic. I think it's a factual approach. But there was spreading towards the end of this period. I mean, it was criticized, particularly by many people who wanted at that time, I'm coming back to that, that they looked upon it as an economic problem and not a race problem. I'm coming back to that. But let me tell you a little story, because I think it's rather important. There was a colleague of mine, a Negro sociologist from one of the Californian universities, who visited me in Stockholm while I was working. And he said, I don't believe at all that you are right. All these white people, they are very cynical. There's not a bit of I mean, all your this that ideals meant something is just nonsense. Well, I said, do you realize that you are a very petty little minority, little more than 10% of the people, and having tremendously much less of everything which gives power and influence than 10%? And if you really meant what you said, that the whites didn't care at all about their ideals, then you could just dump you together in a prison or in a county, send you to Africa, or dump you in the ocean. No, he said, the Supreme Court. And I said, well, my friend, what is the Supreme Court except an institution containing these ideals? If the Americans had, the white big majority had these cynical views, which you say, then they could send the Supreme Court back to Africa either, change the Constitution. After all, here you have constitutions, institutions, which work to preserve ideals. I think this is still correct. This was, of course, at the time the happy time of the rebellion, while the big civil rights legislation were carried out, which incidentally nobody half a year or a year before they were passed in Congress could have believed should have passed. They didn't do that because they were afraid of the Negro, still less then than now after the rebellions. They did it because, I mean, they had this conscience conflict. It was really operating. I think it's still operating. And if you look on a thing like the Riot Commission, and just look on it as an expression of certain traditional American ideals, they are in the great tradition, and even if it's not fulfilled. Well, now, Of course, there was a third general tendency in my book, and that was that for Lord's sake, you have now the forces, this was my argument, you have now the forces which will operate to the advantage of the Negro population, as they did, and use this opportunity, I mean, when you, so to speak, have the tailwind, you know, I mean, to carry out really important structural changes in the American society, its housing, its education, its in all fields, which was not followed. Here I come back to what I said, you know, it's a little disorganized, my introduction, that the very fact that you had a slow movement and everything was quiet meant really it's not only that the lack of scientific work, but that also reflects a sort of lack of interest in carrying out big reforms during this period. It was not popular, not possible to carry out anything in Congress. Well, now, that is the historical perspective. Then came the Negro Rebellion. One very important thing to remember in historical perspective, because you shouldn't always, well, it happened as a, first, it happened as a surprise. Why should it have been a surprise? I mean, if you had had the continuation of scholarly work in our universities, they wouldn't, it's not necessary that such things happen as a surprise. I mean, things have their causes, and we in the scholarly field should be studying the causes. Why should it be taken as a surprise? It happened. It happened in the South, which is natural for several reasons. One reason being, that in the South, the, what you might call the natural leaders, if you excuse me, of the Negro people, which are the Negro middle class, are closed in by professional discrimination as well as social discrimination. They were just left in the Negro field. Of course, the psychology of this Negro middle class, as I analyzed it, and I think this analyze might to a large extent be relevant even now, is that they have they are in a very ambivalent situation. On the one hand, they hate and dislike the lower class Negroes to whom they are allied. On the other hand, they are closed in among them, and they are apt to be their leaders, sometimes to be the most, violently speaking leaders. It's an ambivalent situation. But here they were. And they were top. And this was very much a church thing. If you read Franklin Frazier's excellent posthumous book, little book, about the Negro church, you will have it stressed again that the only really single institution the Negroes were permitted to build up were the churches, the religion, helped there by the segregation, which kept them out. And this was their natural home. There's no other organization, real big, important community organization, which they had the possibility. This they could start to build up already when even the family was not respected. You could sell away your husband or wife, you know. It was not respected. But the church was the general social form. So it was very natural that the church and their preachers could lead this. Then, of course, it spread to the north. There you have a very different situation. Many of these civil rights, which they got now through Congress, the Negroes in the north had for a long period, and in some districts of the north have always had formal civil rights. And nevertheless, it was just horrible, more segregation in the South, and you know all the trouble which the people who are living in the now gradually increasing and more congested Negro ghettos were exposed to. That's one thing. Another difference is, of course, that in the North you have had more of integration to an extent. It was possible to move out professionally for not few middle-class Negroes and have another professional life. And as they had the vote and used the vote, the party machines, political party machines, and other organized interest in the big white world had an interest of being near these leaders and get them to try to deliver the vote and control the Negro community. And these Negroes, whether they were teachers, school, and churches, and everything, they had an access to white people to get support for various things and make their opinions there. And they were, of course, very often, and not entirely without right, in many communities, looked upon as bribed people. So you had the potentialities of the beginning of a class difference within Negro society, in particular, and even to an extent, an age difference, because it was, of course, the established Negro professionals, leaders in the middle class, who had the power. So it was a very different situation. And here you got the riots and all of that. And then, of course, the country is one, so you can, that can affect back, I mean, in south, and you get something. But still, of course, you have had very much more of riots in the north. Well, now, let me go back now to the period. I said a happy period from a point of view before you had clashes, and you carried out all these things. You know, when Lyndon Johnson was explaining to Congress, "We will overcome," and all of that. You must go back a little, where the violence was of a type which mostly worked in the favor of the Negro. I was in Detroit when. You had these pictures of the police dogs, which incidentally is one of the few things which has changed in the situation. There were no police dogs in my time, although it was horrible nevertheless, biting these Negro kids. And the ordinary American, you know, the farmer, the lawyer, the teacher, I always remember, I mean, the ordinary American, he looked on that and said, "This is not right." This was something which worked for the Negro at that time. You could just observe it as a participant observer in this great country. Well, now, in that happy time, you know, the poverty issue, which is a bigger thing, had come up. I don't think, if you look on the origin to the two things, that I think they are rather parallel, because I don't think there was much a change from one to another.